Chapter 10, Some Different Kind of Pope. In September of 1979, when I was a writer at CBS News, John Paul was a new pope, and people in the New York Broadcast Center were still getting used to him. One afternoon, the bells on the AP wire machine, it was the old kind that buzzed and printed out thick rolls of paper and rang when important news occurred, those bells resounded through the room. The editor walked over and read the story. It was a report from Vatican City. It said the new pope had issued a long pastoral letter on the human body, on marriage, on sex and love. The editor began reading and then looked up. "This is some different kind of pope," he said. What the wires were reporting was that the pope had begun giving a series of general audiences in which he addressed the subject of human sexuality. He spoke so lovingly about physical love that it was startling. The last time a pope had spoken at any great length on issues dealing with sexuality, it was 15 years before, when Pope Paul VI restated the Church's position on artificial birth control. His message was, "It is not good, not right, not sanctioned." The declaration proved to be explosive in so many ways in so many circles that barely anyone in the Vatican had mentioned sex since, and the Church continued with its paradoxical reputation as an anti-sex institution that had historically encouraged the most sensual art and the most passionate thinking in all the world, not to mention its love for big families and fruitfulness. John Paul had once been a parish priest, and as parish priest, he had been a marriage counselor. He counseled those who were married and experiencing difficulties in their relationships and those who were about to be married. The counseling was key to the man John Paul would become. If he'd been a church bureaucrat through much of his career and worked in administrative offices that specialized in finances or diplomacy, as some of his predecessor popes had, he would not have had the experience he gained talking with people on intimate terms about how they really lived and what they really felt and struggled with and questioned. He might not have had to ponder their lives and ponder church teaching about those lives. What he learned as priest and then bishop became part of the Pope's definitive statement on, and response to, the modern sexual revolution that even then, when he was a young man in his mid-30s, was beginning to sweep the world. What the priest Karol Wojtyła came to believe, he later said, was that the tradition of Catholic sexual teaching had become too much dominated by the idea of the soul trying to master the body, as if the body were a rather wicked thing waiting to trip one up on the road to salvation. This, he felt, reflected a false reading of church teaching and was neglectful of certain truths that hadn't sufficiently been stated, at least recently. For one thing, the false reading seemed not to take into account what John Paul exalted as the quiet union of body and soul when we are at our best and fully alive and truly experiencing life in the broadest and most joy-filled way. The Pope made it clear in his papal conversations that he was concerned that there was too great a tendency in Western society to view the human body in a confused and superficial way. We view it as something that is outside us, something that belongs to us, that we must control, something that is on some level detached from our inner being. But, he argued, you cannot separate the soul from the body. They are united. They do not exist in opposition to each other. They are together, and together they make you. You cannot separate what your body does from what your will does. Not only that, the particular body you have and were given was meant for the particular soul you were given. So, your body isn't a pretty wrapped box with a gift inside called a soul. The box and the gift are one and enmeshed together. And we know this, or sense it, he said, in many ways. When you are a new mother, for instance, and you hold your newborn in your arms, in those first weeks and months when your body is close to your child and meshed with your child and feeding your child, that is a moment, John Paul said, that tells us something about the unity of body and soul. He also painted a portrait of Rebecca in the Old Testament, seeing Isaac come across the field. She sees him and her heart leaps. She sees him and already she loves him. It's a beautiful image because it speaks of a wholeness. It isn't only her body that is engaged, but her very essence, her spirit and soul, all of her. In the New Testament, John Paul noted, there is the passion of Jesus Christ, a profoundly physical and spiritual agony in which the physical and the spiritual are part of each other. And he said this too suggests the facts of the wholeness and unity of the human person. Now, the Pope was keen to make the point that there is always a tendency among Christians to think of the salvation of the soul and the mastering of the body, as if the body is something to be denied or indulged. Carried to an extreme, he said, this conception suggests the soul is the seat of all goodness and the body is the seat of all badness. But that, he said, is not so. After all, he pointed out, the soul is the seat of pride, which is a big sin. Your arms and your stomach are not. Well, he says, we must shake off this modern conception of the body and see it in a different way. The Pope began his statements on the body by meditating on the story of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. Adam was all alone, without anyone to speak to, with no use even for language. He had no one to touch or look into the eyes of. He was lonely, and God could see it. But there were some parts of this loneliness that must have been intellectually fruitful. For one thing, Adam must have come to understand that he was alone in part because he wasn't an animal or a tree. He was different from everything else. He came to know himself as a person, a human being. But he saw there was no one around like him, and he needed another human person. And so Adam was given Eve. The former Time magazine correspondent Wilton Wynne, who converted to Catholicism after covering John Paul for more than 10 years, later wrote that as a former Baptist, he was struck by the Pope's teaching. The Pope often taught, said Wynne, quoting John Paul, that the word Adam does not mean man, it means human. God created Adam, the human, and then divided it so there was male and female. This, said Wynne, meant that instead of saying man was created and the woman was created from him, John Paul puts it on a level of perfect equality. John Paul taught that Eve was different from Adam, but part of him, and together they composed a fuller image of God. Adam recognizes Eve as flesh of my flesh. In doing so, he becomes part of a complete giving and receiving of another human being. And this, said John Paul, is the great moment of communion, when man, in his duality, becomes the image of God. So, not until he was two was Adam fully one. Eve was the completer, the easer of loneliness. He had a body and she had a body, and together they were one. None of this story, the Pope suggested, is accident, and none of it is without deep meaning for all human beings. John Paul often noted that Christianity is the only religion that promises the resurrection of the body, not just the soul. Many Catholics forget this, even though every time we go to Mass we say the Apostles' Creed. We look for the resurrection of the dead and the life of the world to come. Such a doctrine can leave you wondering, how and exactly what way does this happen? Which body is resurrected? The innocent one when you were a toddler? The strong one you had when you were 25? The older one you died with? Well, we don't know, but the central message stands. Catholicism isn't only about the salvation of our souls, but the salvation of our body. But there is more to learn from the story of Adam and Eve, John Paul said. Their giving to each other shows that sexuality was built into men and built into women from the beginning. And in the beginning, it didn't involve any shame. Shame, the Pope taught, is the result of fear. Fear that we are or have become an object. Fear that we actually see another person as an object or use him or her as an object of pleasure or desire. George Weigel here offers understanding of the Pope's thinking. George wrote, "Sin, the Pope explains, enters the world as a corruption of genuine self-giving, which is always motivated by love. When that self-giving is experienced as restraint rather than fulfillment, love decays into lust, and the icon of created goodness that was sexual love in the beginning, in the Pope's words, is broken." What happens then? Well, human beings lose their original certainty that the world is good and we are fit for living in it. Here, Weigel says, explaining the Pope's thinking, the difference between male and female, once a source of identity and communion, becomes a source of confrontation. Mere lust shatters the communion between people. But the Christian sexual ethic, the Pope asserted, redeems sexuality from that dead end. George Weigel again. Far from prohibiting eros, the Christian ethic liberates eros. For, in the Pope's words now, full and mature spontaneity, in which the attraction of the sexes finds its fulfillment in mutual self-giving. This, John Paul argued, is not the banishment or denial of desire, it is the full expression of desire. The Pope then went on to celebrate marital love, and I believe this was the part of John Paul's statement that made my editor at CBS say, "This is some different kind of Pope." Because when the Pope spoke of sexuality within marriage, he expressed himself in a way that showed no awkwardness or reservation, but rather a robust warmth. Sexual love in marriage, he said, is an act of worship, of deep human creativity. The language of the body provides a way of encountering the sacred, and the sacred is a way of encountering God. The sexual giving of oneself, he said, makes the world a better place. It is, in fact, a way to sanctify the world. When I read this, I found it startling. Everyone thinks the church tries to diminish sex or make it less central or less important to people. But this Pope was saying, it's bigger than you know. It is transcendent. The Pope teaches that it is in the unity of body and soul that the person is the subject of his own moral acts. You cannot dissociate the moral act from the bodily dimension of its exercise. The human person in his totality is a soul that expresses itself in a body, and a body informed by an immortal soul. They stand and fall together. These teachings carry through into rather obvious ones on sexuality outside of marriage. I spoke to Michael Novak about it. He said, "Adultery and so forth introduce a discordance that violates the unity of body and soul. It is a violation of one's very nature, and it starts the chords ringing discordantly. It does so pleasantly and bewitchingly. That is why Dante put such sins in the less terrible rings of hell, because there seems to be a kind of sharing. But it appears to be full and permanent when it is not. It is only temporary." Sexual activity outside the sacrament of marriage, again according to Novak, compromises the soul's honesty and integrity. It makes it doubt itself. It launches a principle of untruthfulness into the soul and body, and that devalues both over time. It leads, he said, to the jading of everyday life. I think that is a wonderful phrase to sum up our time, the jading of everyday life. It's a time when both men and women are more confused by one another, more defended against one another, when they speak sometimes more disparagingly about their relations and are more cynical about the other's motives and their own. The Pope suggested that this unhappiness is not the result of the war between men and women, but rather of not understanding that men and women are not, in fact, and were not made to be, at war. They were made to complete one another in trust, with authenticity and delight. Why did the Pope turn his attention to this subject? In part to more fully explain and expand upon the Church's true teachings, in part to make new what had been forgotten or distorted with time, in part to give instruction to priests of the Church so they in turn could help their flock, and in part because John Paul knew, even back in the 1970s, that the meaning of human sexuality was a rising issue of fascination and anxiety in the modern world. And in part, I suspect because of this, we are suffering in the West through an imbalanced period of cultural history, a time that seems to mark both an obsessive interest in and an anxious, even combative attitude toward the human body. In a way, we seem not so comfortable in our own skin. We are at war with our nature. Sex is treated as a search for the perfect moment with the perfect man or the perfect woman. There is more sexual information and instruction than ever before, but all of it seems predicated on dissatisfaction. In many of our schools, we teach our sons and daughters that sexuality is a mechanical function, freed pretty much from meaning. We teach them about condoms and their use and reliability. And then we feel discomfort when our children, as young adults, begin to treat sexuality as if it were a function free of meaning and robbed of import. Women become angry with men. You used me. And men with women. You tricked me. It is all very confused. And maybe the beginning of the confusion, its source, is an inability to see the unity of body and soul and the deep significance, therefore, of the sexual act. In the West, we are in such a paradoxical position. We obsess on sex in our schools and our media as if it were the most important thing in the world, and yet our very obsession undercuts its importance and makes it banal and common and sort of unimportant. We get it all wrong. And if you get that wrong, nothing that follows is really going to make much sense. Michael Novak again, he said, "There is something about our bodies that tells us what God is like. And if we mess that up, we mess God up too." The Pope's teachings on the body reflected, I think, his deep and natural comfort with the body, a comfort with the idea of our physical being. He had lived a life in which he took great joy in his physicality. He was an athlete from boyhood on, playing soccer and hiking and kayaking and swimming. This was him being himself and using his body. I think of John Paul doing something he truly loved, hiking in the hills above Rome and praying and sometimes singing after praying, up there in the mountains in the air. Such a life is worlds away from the funny modern relationship we have with our own bodies. We obsess on our physical form, making it slim and smooth and perfect. We tell ourselves we do this because we love our bodies and want them to be beautiful. But I wonder sometimes if we don't secretly fear or dislike our bodies. And so we redesign them and are never satisfied with them and try, against sense, to insist that they be young-looking and perfect. A friend of mine told me recently that when you've been away from America for a while, and then return to Manhattan, you are amazed by the number of women who have had a great deal of surgery done on their faces. He said, they all look like sisters. He said, they seem to be part of a big family. They all look related, as if they come from a family where no one has brow lines and everyone has big pronounced cheekbones. The other night I saw Placido Domingo in Cyrano at the Met. And I must tell you, I could not resist the thought that this deep and witty drama could not be written now because the audience would sit there, watch the opening, and look at each other and say, why doesn't he just get a nose job? Today, of course, he would, and one of the most human and tender of all stories would never have been told. When I was questioning intellectuals and writers who study the Pope on his teachings regarding the body and the soul, one man I spoke to was perplexed by my questions. He said, well, you know the answers. It's all in the piece you wrote about Karen Hughes. This surprised me, and I thought for a minute. I went back to the piece, which I had published in the Wall Street Journal's online editorial page on April of 2002, after George Bush's advisor, Karen Hughes, announced she was going to leave the White House. Her departure struck me as a beautiful and heartening decision if, as I suspected, it was driven by a desire to leave the grinding intensity of political work and return to the daily enjoyment of life. So I wrote a piece called Back to Life. This is what I said. What is life? It is the nice big thing you enter each morning when the alarm goes off and you put your feet on the cool floor and then you stand with your hands on the bottom of your back and you look out the window. Life is putting on coffee, picking up the newspaper and putting on the radio and listening for a few seconds to see if something huge and terrible happened last night. You can always tell by the sound of the voices. Once you hear everyone sounds calm and nice and boring, you can keep the station on, but you don't really listen. The mist from the coffee in the mug is rising. The sun hits the newspaper you're reading as you stand at the kitchen counter, and you feel it on your hand. You think, that's the feel of the sun on my hand. You open the kitchen window and breathe in fresh air. Grass. The man next door just mowed the lawn. It's fresh and cool. You hear birds. You leave the window open so you can keep hearing them. You think, maybe I'll put a birdhouse back there. You notice you do not have a hard little ball in your stomach. Your acid glands do not appear to have launched the morning's guerrilla attack on the bagel you are eating. Your heartbeat is not accelerating. You do not have the slight tremor you sometimes get when the phone rings so often it's come to seem like a constant alarm. The rictus muscles around your mouth are not tightening. You are not frowning. What's happening? Oh, you've returned to life. You are standing there reading the front page, and the front page does not contain information you must respond to. It contains information other people must respond to. The mayor, say, or the head of the arts committee. You wish them well. You have only one fear. For a long time you've had a hunch that fear keeps you slim, that anxiety creates a quicker metabolism, that happiness will make you fat. You think, I think I'll worry about that next week or next month. Then you get dressed. You dress in soft clothes. That's what cops and firemen in New York and members of the armed services call not being in uniform. You wear soft old jeans and a thin cotton sweater. They smell of Tide and fabric softener. They feel warm from the dryer. They drape on you like an oversized glove. When Karen Hughes worked in the White House, she wore hard clothes, wool blend suits and heels and jewelry and makeup. There were buttons and fasteners and flecks of mascara in the eye. She doesn't have to wear makeup now. She can have a soft face. She can wash her face in Dove foamy cleanser, pat it dry, put on a nice-smelling moisturizer, and walk forward into the day. And in that day, she can daydream. This is especially important for intelligent people. It's how they find out what they think. She can walk and go for long drives. This is important for adults as it allows them unconsciously to absorb through their eyes a changing landscape while they think about things big and small, all of which relate to time going by, meaning to a changing of landscapes. She can not answer the phone. Not answering the phone is a very great gift in life. When you answer the phone, other humans very often bring you their need. I need you to listen, know, react, advise. They get you on their agenda. When you don't answer the phone, you can stay on your agenda, which may or may not be clear, but at least it's yours. She can shop. Shopping is a wonderful thing. It's more wonderful if you have money to buy what catches your eye if you want to own it, but it's also wonderful if you don't have money. It's really wonderful to just sort of walk along the mall and see what your country is selling and buying and offering. You get to see the other people look at and judge your country's products. You can buy a big soft pretzel at a stand and sit on a bench and watch the mothers and daughters buy shoes together. If you sit close enough to hear them, you'll be hearing how mothers and daughters talk to each other these days, and that's a good thing to know. Then you can have lunch with friends and bring each other your agendas, which is a word you would never use with friends because you don't have to. You know each other so well you don't have an agenda. Or you have one, but it's unspoken and shared and simple. It is, we're friends, we help each other through life. Then you can go home and read a book in a chair outside or on your bed with the sunlight streaming in on the comforter. It's good to read. When you read books by people who know things you don't know, or rather who know things you don't know and would benefit intellectually, spiritually, or emotionally from knowing, you are giving your brain or soul good nutrients. No one ever got stupider or shallower or worse from doing this. You can think of dinner. You can make it or order it. You can think of what everyone would enjoy and then try to make sure it'll be good for them too. You can watch the news and be interested like a normal person by what's going on, as opposed to being interested like an abnormal person, a person who works for a president, say. You can watch TV shows with your son and husband and just enjoy them. You can daydream to them and have uninterrupted thoughts about what's happening in Hollywood and what's happening with people who are 27 and secretly running the country. You can have these thoughts uninterrupted by bells that ring like alarms and agendas that are thrust on you and things you must attend to or the president may suffer. You can become reacquainted with your country. You can become reacquainted with the idea of normality. You can find out how much or how little you miss the great world. You can figure the difference between how much it needed you and how much you needed it. You can find out how much you need the distractions you used to complain about, and you can find out if you were right that you didn't need them. You can find out what comes in to fill and take the place of the pressure, pleasure, and importance you just left. You have to try and make sure that space is filled by better things, but you have to be open-minded, easy, and welcoming about the word better. It can have broad meanings you did not expect. So let me tell you why I'm riffing along here. I have a feeling the Hughes plan is related to September 11th. The other day, a writer friend emailed me and said, "Quick, give me a quote on September 11th and how it changed your life." She was writing an article, and she just needed another voice to jump in and give words she could put quote marks around. I didn't know the answer, or rather, I knew a bunch of answers, but I didn't know one. My friend, however, needed one. So I sat and I thought, and then I knew. I wrote back, "Let me tell you what 9/11 did to me. It made me hungrier for life. It made me feel more tenderly toward it and more grateful. It's all short. Even in the worst life, it's too short. And you want to really feel it and experience it and smell it and touch it, and you want to thank God for it. I realized again that September 11th had given me a case of Judith Delouvrier. Now, Judith Delouvrier was a wonderful woman who was my friend. Our boys, our sons, went to school together, and she was a fine mother and a happy spirit, and she loved her husband, and they'd just left their apartment and bought a house in my neighborhood in Manhattan. She had a million plans. She jumped on a plane one summer day, and she never came back. It was TWA 800. It was all so impossible, so jarring, so unnatural. And in the months and years after her death, if I was walking along and saw something nice, like a pretty baby or a dog or a sweet moment between humans or a beautiful pair of shoes in a store window, if I saw that, I'd feel my usual old mild pleasure. And then I would remember that Judith couldn't see this boring, common, unremarkable thing. And it made the boring, common, unremarkable thing seem to me more like a gift, more precious, more worthy of attention and appreciation and even love. So September 11th did to me what Judith's death did, only deeper and newer. And Karen Hughes, who was with the president in the days after September 11th, maybe she got a case of September 11th, too, and maybe it made some part of her want to be more immersed in life, or more urgently aware that life is not only what you're doing right this second at the desk. It's also going on out there beyond the desk. It's going by like the wind, and if you want, you can step out and feel it. Why did my friend suggest I already knew the relation of body and soul? Because he inferred from my essay what I had not even thought of, but had nonetheless repeatedly suggested. What you do with your body has an impact on your soul, how you live each day, the circumstances of your daily life. That has an impact on your soul, because you are a body and a soul, and the reality of one is the reality of the other.